Let's pivot back to this morning a minute. We are going to be welcoming Andy Root. I know a bunch of you yesterday went to a marriage seminar that he and his wife, Cara, hosted, which has been such a powerful experience. Andy Root, if you're not familiar with him, he's a professor of youth and family studies at Luther Seminary in Minneapolis. He's written several books about faith formation, being a pastor, youth ministry. And it's no exaggeration to say that around here at Mars Hill, probably the past 10 years of our Mars Hill student ministry has been deeply impacted by Andy's work. His fingerprints are all over this place. And so we're so grateful that he's here with us today to be teaching us. I personally have found him to be a man of authenticity. He's practical, he's thoughtful, he's wicked smart. And so I'm just glad for his voice in our community today. So in a minute, I'm going to welcome him up. But for right now, I'm going to read the teaching text. I saw our Bible carriers, if you do not have a Bible, you can get one out of the back of the room on one of our Bible carts. But we are going to be in the book of Mark 9. So Mark 9, if you're in a shed Bible, this is on page 931, Mark 9. We're going to start out at verse 2. Mark 9, verse 2. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what to say. They were so frightened. Then a cloud appeared and covered them, and a voice came from the cloud, "This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him." Suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. They kept the matter to themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant. Then we're going to flip over the page to verse 14. When they came to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and the teachers of the law arguing with them. As soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder and ran to greet him. "What are you arguing with them about?" he asked. A man in the crowd answered, "Teacher, I brought you my son who is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashing his teeth, and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they couldn't." "You unbelieving generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me." So they brought him. When the spirit saw him, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. He fell to the ground and rolled around, foaming at the mouth. Jesus asked the boy's father, "How long has he been like this?" "From childhood," he answered. "It has often thrown him into fire or water to kill him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." "If you can," said Jesus, "everything is possible for one who believes." Immediately, the boy's father exclaimed, "I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief." When Jesus saw that a crowd was running to the scene, he rebuked the evil spirit. "You deaf and mute spirit," he said, "I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." The spirit shrieked, convulsed him violently, and came out. The boy looked so much like a corpse that many said he's dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him to his feet, and he stood up. This is the word of the Lord. If you could join me in giving a Mars Hill welcome to Andy Root.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, and it was beautiful to see the dedications, and so commendable of the parents to make dedications here. But I want to remind you as a community, and particularly as an outsider to this community, that you too are making dedications to these children, and that having them stand up here is you dedicating to help pass on faith to these young ones. Now, for a while, I've been thinking about this question of how we pass on faith to a younger generation of people, and it's not easy. And a lot of people are very anxious about how we do this, and the statistics seem to be showing that it's not going so well. There's been a loss of a lot of affiliation and connection of young people to Christianity in general. So a few years ago, my friend Kenda Creasy Dean and I wrote this book called The Theological Turn in Youth Ministry. The way I describe this book is it's the book with the really angry kids on the cover. I'm not so sure why they're mad, but the publisher tells me they're mad at you for not buying enough copies of the book. But we won't go there. But in this book, we tried to really get into this question of how do we pass on faith to another generation of people. And we had a sense that a lot of people who were doing this were quite tired. But let me make a confession on, well, probably that many authors should make, is that often you write a book, and it's not until you stand up in front of a group of people like this that you really know what you are talking about. Now, I stand by this book and think you should buy a couple copies for yourself and your kitten, but we weren't quite so clear, I think, on what we were asking people to turn away from and what we were asking them to turn towards. Now, I think we were clear that we were asking people, when they think about passing on faith to young people, to turn away from thinking about faith and passing on faith as a technology, to not think about it as a technology, which a lot of churches fall into the trap of thinking about passing on faith to young people as a technology. Now, don't get me wrong, I really like technology. Actually, I speak to a lot of young pastors who are on Twitter, and what I've discovered is that if you deconstruct the Bible for them, they think you're really cool, but if you insult Twitter, they stab you in the hallway. So let me be very, very clear. I like technology. I'm into technology. I actually have an Apple Watch, so all of us who have Apple Watches are better than all the rest of you. I like technology. Technology is a very good thing. But there is a way that technology frames our imagination. It gives us a sense of how we solve problems, about how we think of what a good life is. And overall, what technology does for us in some good ways but some bad ways is technology tends to say that everything is a problem and there's some functional solution to solve that problem. I don't know if you have this feeling, but I have this feeling. I watch the news or I read an article and they say that ice caps are melting. We could have ecological disaster. It feels like a big problem. But somewhere deep inside me, I also think, well, someone's probably going to create an app to fix it. Like, we have a sense that even our deepest problems have some technical solution to solve them. Or to give you a cinema example, remember that classic movie from, I don't know, about 8-10 years ago? Remember Tom Hanks' movie, Apollo 13? Remember Apollo 13? If you're too young to remember Apollo 13, first of all, we hate you. But secondly, you should go watch it. If actually you just turn on TNT, it's probably on right now. It just keeps running over and over again. So if you haven't seen this movie, it's about Tom Hanks is leading this moon mission. They're going to be the second group. It's a historical biopic. He's going to land on the moon, his crew. They're going to be the second group to ever land on the moon. They get up into their lunar orbit. Do you remember this part of the movie? And something goes wrong with a spacecraft, and we get one of the greatest cinematic lines of all time. We get Tom Cruise relaying back down to Earth. He says, "Houston, I think we have a problem." And the problem is they are not going to land on the moon, but worse, they are not going to be able to get these men back to Earth. They don't think so. The next scene is Ed Harris, who's like the engineer down in Houston, gathers his best thinkers. They get into a boardroom. He walks in with a cardboard box. He dumps it out on the table and he says, "Boys, this is all they have up there." It's like the cover to the lunar manual, a screwdriver, a roll of duct tape. It's like, get them from the moon back into the Earth's atmosphere. And of course, the whole point of the movie is they do it. They rescue these men. Technology can do some amazing things. But those very things it can do puts into our minds that everything we face is a problem with some step-by-step technical solution. Or let me show you in diagram form what I mean by this, is we could think of technology as science that's used to solve a problem. It's used to solve a problem that then provides some kind of new form that should bring exponential growth. So think about when Apple made the move with their home button and they made the transition from that just basic home button to the home button that read your fingerprint. Apple realized they had a problem. The problem was a security issue with their phone. So they get their best technologists on it and they create a new form, a very new form of the home button that reads your fingerprint. And they know when they put that into the next derivative of iPhones, Apple stock will go up. Now I think what's happened when we think about our young people is children's ministry and youth ministry has become the church's technology. We have a problem. The problem is we're not sure even how to talk to our kids about faith. We're not sure how to pass it on. So we need some big program. And if we can just do that, if we can just have this new form of youth ministry, this new form of children's ministry, this new form and new curriculum of how to talk to our own children about faith, then that will solve the problem. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. And it hasn't worked that way. So we were asking people to turn away from thinking about passing on faith to the next generation as a technology. Now, the second thing we weren't quite so clear about, and we got lucky, but this wasn't the theology turn in youth ministry. Sometimes people will say, well, you know, it's easy to pass on faith to your kids. All you do is you sit them down and you read John Calvin to them, and that's it. Like, just teach them doctrine and you've got it. Now, one of the first ministry experiences I ever had, I had just graduated from high school. I was a freshman in college, and my youth pastor I grew up with asked me to help lead a ninth grade small group at our youth ministry. So I was honored. Well, we were going to have a fall retreat, and for some reason, I couldn't make it on the bus to go up to the camp with the ninth graders. So I had a late class or something. So I was going to go up with another leader who was going up late, and this was Ryan. Ryan was going up late, and he was going to drive me up there. And I was a first-year college student, but Ryan was a first-year seminary student. And we all love first-year seminary students. They're the best. We want more. If you want to go to seminary, talk to me. But here's the thing about first-year seminary students. They're all just a tad bit annoying. Beautiful people, but just a tad bit annoying. And that's right where Ryan was. He was 6 weeks into this thing. So we're driving up, and Ryan says, you know, we have to be done with this fun and game stuff with these ninth graders. Like, when we do ministry with young people, we need theology. We need to do theology. Now, at the time, I couldn't even spell theology, so that made a lot of sense to me, so I just nodded along. We got to the camp, we parked, we got out to join the ninth graders, and he said to me, watch, tomorrow I do the talk, and I'm going to give these kids theology. Sure enough, at 10 a.m. the next day, he got up to give the talk to 40 ninth graders, and boy, did he give them theology. It was about 25 minutes of everything he'd learned in his first semester at seminary. There was parsed Hebrew verbs, a whole conversation about the ancient Israel temple system, a conversation about which Pauline epistles do we know for sure Paul wrote. And I could watch these ninth graders every 5 minutes, the gravity of his theology pushing them to the ground. And finally, he prayed for them, and they were like in a well-oiled boys' choir. They all stood up in unison and raced out the back door as if to leave the minutiae of his theology. I love theology. I think it's really important. If I could only read one more thing, I would read theology. But I'm not sure just getting information in our kids' heads is what will pass on faith to them. We got lucky, and that actually what we were calling for is exactly what the title said, that we are calling for a theological turn in youth ministry, a theological turn in passing on faith to a younger generation. Now, I'm trying to parse the difference between theology and the theological, and so your correct response is to go numb. Like, what? This is too early in the morning, not enough coffee for this. So I want to explain it by the theological starts somewhere different. The theological actually starts with the lived and concrete experience of people. It starts with their big questions. So to give you a better example of this, I want to turn to the thinker Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer, if you don't know him, was one of the most interesting Christian thinkers of the 20th century. And if you want to read a fascinating biography, you just read Bonhoeffer's biography, because he entered into a conspiracy to overthrow Hitler in the last days of World War II and then was killed. He was one of a martyr of his faith in the 20th century. Very interesting story. But if you read that biography, I have to warn you that if you read it, you'll start to feel bad about yourself. And you won't feel bad because Bonhoeffer did all these great commitments. You'll feel bad about yourself because Bonhoeffer was like a child prodigy. And he actually started his doctoral dissertation at 19 years old. And he finished his PhD at 21. And now you're thinking, my gosh, I'm 35 and I've done nothing with my life. That's how you feel when you read about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. But Bonhoeffer had a problem because he had finished his doctoral dissertation at 21 years old. And in Germany at this time, to be a pastor, to be an ordained pastor, you needed to be 25. And to be a professor, you needed to basically be about that same age. So he had actually gone too fast. So his ordination committee, the people who were overseeing his preparation for ministry, said, you know what you should do? You should go to Barcelona and do a year-long internship. So Dietrich goes in 1928 to Barcelona to do a year-long internship. And we have a letter he wrote that's really interesting, and I think it highlights what I mean by the theological here. Now, what's even more fascinating about this letter is this letter wasn't discovered until 1999. The man it's addressed to and sent to is a man by the name of Walter Dress. And when he died in the late 90s, they cleaned out his apartment and found a cache of letters, one from Dietrich Bonhoeffer in 1928. So it has a kind of antiques roadshow kind of feel to it. But I want to talk to you about this letter because I think it highlights this and gives us a picture of how we pass on faith to our children, to our young people. In the letter, Dietrich writes Walter Dress, and he says to him, "Have you read Emil Brunner's new book, The Divine Imperative?" Now, Emil Brunner is probably at this time the second most important theologian on all the continent of Europe, maybe in all of the world at this time. And he's just written a book on ethics, and Dietrich's been very interested in ethics. And so Dietrich asks Walter Dress, "Have you read it?" And then Dietrich says in the letter, "I've read it, and it's deeply disappointing," he says. "I'm so ashamed of Brunner. Oh, Brunner's failed so deeply. Oh, Brunner. I had to quit the book 90 pages before the end. Brunner has totally failed." So here is this 22-year-old kid with the his ink on his dissertation still wet who just rips apart Emil Brunner. But then the whole letter changes. The dynamic of it changes, and Dietrich must have remembered something he wanted to share with Walter Dress. And he says, "I have to tell you what happened to me." He says, "The other day at 10 a.m., an 11-year-old boy came over to my apartment. I had asked his family if I could borrow something, and he dropped it off." And Dietrich says, "I know this boy. This boy is exuberant. I can't get him to sit still in Sunday school class. I know this boy quite well. But when he came into my flat to drop this off, I noticed that he was sullen. He was down." So Dietrich just tells Walter Dress that he attuned himself to the humanity of the boy, was just aware that there was something wrong. After a few minutes, Dietrich puts his hand on the 11-year-old boy's shoulder and says, "Are you okay?" And the boy just starts crying and crying and crying. Tears are everywhere. So this is a different time. This is the 1920s. So Dietrich picks the boy up and puts the boy on his knee and just shares in his sadness, is just with him. And in many ways, that's the point. Just is with this boy as he cries. I had an experience in my first paid youth ministry job was to work for the organization called Young Life. And our job was to take kids who had never heard the gospel story to camp. And it was just my first year, and I had been given 30 camp spots, and it was always difficult to fill these camp spots, and I had done it. I had, in my first year, filled all 30 spots, and I felt really good about myself. I pulled a muscle, patting myself on the back. And I was really felt good because I even got kids who really fit the mission of the organization, kids who'd never been to church, who never heard the gospel story. And one of those kids was Adam. And Adam was like a 6'3 ninth grader who, this was in Minnesota, he had played varsity hockey as a ninth grader in Minnesota, which is a very big deal. And he had done it because he was big and he was mean. I mean, he would cross-check you in the teeth if he needed to. But I got him to go to camp. He was going to hear the gospel story for the first time. So we got to camp. All the kids got out of the bus about 2 hours after being there, they ring this bell, and you go to this building, and they have this thing they call the club. Music, some skits, but then the speaker comes out and starts sharing the gospel story that the young people will hear over the next 4 nights. Well, this is just, we just got there. And the speaker is only a few minutes in, and I look over at big, tough Adam, and he's crying. And I think what any youth worker thinks, seeing him crying, I think, We got him. So I'm new in ministry, but I'm sensitive enough to wait till it's over and everyone clears out of the room. And now Adam's leaning against the wall with his hands over his face. And I come up to him and I said, "Adam, do you want to go for a walk?" And so we're walking around the camp. And just like this boy Bonhoeffer's talking to, he is sobbing, just crying and crying. And I say, "Adam, what's wrong?" And the tears just come harder, and he's crying and crying. I say, "What is it?" And he says, it's just, and I know what it just is. It's just Jesus. That's what it is. And he says, it's just, and now I'm thinking, like, what chapter will it be in? Because clearly this night will change his life. He'll become a missionary in some far-off country. He'll then, in about 30 years, write his biography, and there'll be a whole chapter about me. But will it be the first half of the book, or will it be the second half of the book? That's what I'm thinking as he's trying to get his composure. And he's saying, it's just, I'm like, come on, man. Yeah, it's just Jesus. I know, come on. It's just Jesus. And he says, it's just, she doesn't even know I exist. And I promise you all, I didn't say anything, but I bit my bottom lip so hard, and I thought it deep in my soul. I thought, you stupid kid. I thought, here we are talking about salvation in Jesus, and you're talking about this, you're thinking about this girl, but it was worse. Then it was like a movie flashbacks, because then I was flashed back to him on the bus flirting with her, and then I was back to like 6 months ago when he signed up for camp, and wait a minute, she signed up to go to camp before he ever signed up to go to camp. He didn't decide to go to camp because he thought I was the coolest youth worker he ever met. He signed up because he loved this girl. He had a crush on her. He got to camp. We got off the bus. He thought, I am not waiting till day two to ask her out. We are going to have 5 romantic days at camp. Right before club, he asked her out. She rejected him. He sat in club and didn't hear a word the speaker said and just cried about his broken heart. And I said, you stupid kid. Now, I don't have to tell you all today, not great ministry. This was a real experience for him of rejection and of loss. And if there wasn't a way I could come alongside him and hear that story and even proclaim the depth of God's love next to that rejection, then what is the gospel after all? The gospel is about this living Christ who comes to us in the depth of our lived experience. Well, of course, Dietrich Bonhoeffer does way better than me because he's Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And he has this boy, and this boy is crying on his knee. And in the midst of the tears, he starts to be able to make out words. He starts to be able to hear something. He can hear the boy saying, Mr. Wolf is dead. Mr. Wolf is dead. And Dietrich says in the letter back to Walter Dress, and who is Mr. Wolf? Dietrich says, oh, Mr. Wolf is a 3-year-old German shepherd dog who just hours earlier had died. So Dietrich just holds the boy on his knee and lets him cry about his dead dog. This is what our young people need. They need adults in this church who will be close enough to be with them. But it becomes more, and there's another step to this, is that then Dietrich just gives him the space and the boy narrates his experience. The boy tells Dietrich about how much he loved this dog, about how this dog welcomed him home, about how this dog woke him up every morning. He's allowed to narrate his experience, and Dietrich is just with him. This is what we do for our children. We're with them to allow them to narrate this experience. But then something happens. Something happens that's profound. Dietrich tells Walter Dress that the boy told this story, wiped the tears from his eyes, looked at Dietrich and said, you tell me now, Herr Bonhoeffer. You tell me now, will I see Mr. Wolf again in heaven? Will I see Mr. Wolf again? And Dietrich says he had no idea what to say to this boy. Dietrich said that he actually had not taken the class on dead dogs in his PhD program. He wasn't sure what to say. And then Dietrich says to Walter Dress that in the shadow of this 11-year-old boy's question, Dietrich Bonhoeffer says this. He said, I felt small next to his question. Now, I want to remind you how this letter starts. This arrogant young theologian ripping apart Emil Brunner's theology. When it's about just theology and ideas, he rips it apart. But when an 11-year-old boy asks him a question about where is his dog after it dies in tears, this arrogant young theologian feels small because he stumbled onto holy ground. He stumbled on a place where Jesus Christ is present, ministering life out of death, coming near to those who are brokenhearted. And so Dietrich doesn't know what to do. He's not sure how to answer. And many of us have had this experience with our own children of what do we say when they ask this big question. So Dietrich told Walter Dress that unfortunately the boy wanted a yes or no answer. It wasn't going to do to just punt on the whole thing. So Dietrich thought for a second and he said to the boy, well, we know that God is love. And we know, oh, do we know that God loves you. And you, oh you loved Mr. Wolf. And God loves all God's creations, particularly animals. So he looked at the boy, took a deep breath, and said, yes. Yes, I think you'll see Mr. Wolf again in heaven, because I don't believe God loses anything that God loves. So it's good news this morning, at least for some of us who are dog lovers, at least for Dietrich Bonhoeffer, all dogs do go to heaven. But it's profound. And this is what I mean to take a theological turn as we pass on faith to our young children. You don't need a bunch of degrees. You don't need to have read everything. But you do need to be close enough to these young people that when they have these experiences, that you can ask them, what is this like? That you can be there when they say, where is God in the midst of this? Well, it becomes a profound reality because then Dietrich says that the boy turned to him and the boy started to do the theological himself. The boy started to think the Christian tradition alongside him. And the boy said, you know, I got very mad at Adam and Eve today because they ate that fruit. And because they ate that fruit, Mr. Wolf died. And then started talking about what he learned in a religion class. And he started to think the depth of the Christian tradition. But he thought it next to his searching for, where is God next to this pain of me being all alone? My favorite biblical text is the one that we read earlier, the Mark 9 text, and it's a wonderful passage because I really do think it should be like a mini-series, like an HBO mini-series or something. There's so much human pathos in it. We have this father, and things are not going well for this father. His boy is in a bad state, and we don't know this from the text, but you just kind of get the feeling from it that this has been going on. Well, we know it's been going on since childhood, but we get this kind of sense like he's not allowed to be in any more classrooms. That maybe no other kids in the neighborhood are allowed to play with him. That maybe the tension of what is wrong with him has even started to divide mom and dad. There's just so much pathos in this experience. And again, we don't know this from the text, but we get this sense that this father has tried just about everything he can to help his boy. And maybe this is his last option. Maybe they have been to every doctor and every specialist and nothing has worked, but they hear there's this healer from the Galilee and they decide to walk and to go. And maybe, we don't know this again, but maybe they've been walking for days. And every step the father thinks, this is my last best chance, and this has got to work. And maybe Jesus is even out of his healthcare network, but he's willing to go out of network to see if he can find a solution for his boy. So they walk and walk and walk. Well, Jesus is with his disciples, and Jesus takes his three best buddies, Peter, James, and John, and they decide to go up on a mountain and to get away a little bit. So the father walks and he finally gets to where Jesus is supposed to be and he says, I'm here to see Jesus. And they look at him and say, we're sorry, but Jesus isn't here. Jesus is actually on vacation. And he is. He's taking Peter, James, and John. They've loaded up a cooler of soda and hot dogs. They got their Weber grill and they're going up the mountain to have a bromance getaway. And it's going pretty well. They're having a good time. And then all of a sudden it starts getting really weird. A fog descends on the mountain, and then all of a sudden it becomes like the movie Sixth Sense. They start seeing dead people, and there's Elijah, and there's Moses. And then Peter, who, if you don't know Peter, Peter's the disciple who has a mouth that's shaped like a foot. And so Peter interrupts. I mean, there's Jesus talking with Elijah and Moses. And Peter's like, hey, I don't mean to interrupt, but I thought, hey, would it be a good idea if I built three shelters, one for you, one for Elijah, and one for Moses? And in Mark's version, in the parenthetical, in parentheses, it says, he did not know what he's saying. The NIV kind of massages it a little bit. But if you read it in more of the original or more of an original translation, it said it did not know what he's saying, which a direct translation of this is really super stupid thing to say. So Peter interrupts the moment with a stupid thing. Then we get a voice from heaven that says, this is my son. Listen to him. And bam, it's over. And James and John are just holding their s'more sticks like, whoa, this was incredibly trippy. Well, down below, the father is told that Jesus is on vacation, so what's he supposed to do? Again, we don't know this, but maybe he's walked for days. So what's he supposed to do? He turns to the disciples and says, you've been with this Jesus, heal my boy. And then one of the most tragic stories of the New Testament happens. They try, and it fails. There's nothing more painful than having worked yourself up with hope that this time it will work. This time it will happen. This time it will be okay. And then find your life crashing up against the rocks of impossibility again. And this father is broken. And there's chaos everywhere. And just in that exact moment, Jesus walks into the scene. And Jesus walks into the scene, and he's got some harsh things to say to the disciples. But then he does something profound. Is he turns to the father, and he says to him, "How long has your boy been like this?" Now, we miss it as modern people, because we think the how long is a diagnostic question. Like when you go to the doctor and the doctor says, "How long has your elbow felt this way?" Or, "How long has the rash been there?" Or you take your computer into IT tomorrow and they say, "How long has it been since the operating system has booted up?" We think this is a diagnostic question. It is not a diagnostic question. There's no other correlation of Jesus asking diagnostic questions in his healing miracles. This is not a diagnostic question. This is the invitation for this father to articulate and narrate the depth of his experience, to share the depth of his experience. And he does. And Jesus shares in it. And the father, in the midst of being able to tell the story again, finds just enough strength in the midst of all of his brokenness to say again, "But teacher, if you are able," just a little flicker of hope, "but teacher, if you are able," and Jesus stops him and says, "If I am able, I was just up on a mountain with Moses and Elijah. If I am able, all things are possible for those who believe." And the father then makes this deep proclamation of New Testament faith where he says, "I believe, help my unbelief." As you dedicated children today, as these little ones grow, and as you have older ones in your midst, what you dedicate to is being near enough to them, not all of them, but a few of them, to be near enough to them to say to them, "How long? How long have you felt like no one cares for you? Look at me, I'm here. How long have you wondered what you're good at? How long have you wondered if there's no future in this world? How long have you needed a friend? How long have you wondered about that? That's an amazing thought. How long?" The depth of the gospel is this question, how long? And we pass on faith to our children when we're near enough to hear them articulate their stories and for us to ask them and invite them to tell their stories by asking, "How long?" Let me pray for us. God, thank you so much for this community. And would you continue to lead them in their ministry in the world, a ministry that embraces their children and the children of this community and seeks for you by being near enough to ask, "How long?" And may we hear you asking us even now with our own stories of fear and brokenness that you are near us, inviting us to share in your life as you share in ours by asking, "How long?" Amen.